Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Libromania, a podcast for the book obsessed from the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, and each week I'm chatting with authors, biographers, designers, collectors, critics, and other people who help make books so worthy of our attention. This is chapter 19, in which I chat with Dr. Christopher Hull about Graham Greene's mysterious life as an international spy, while also writing some of the most beloved books of the 20th century, including Our Man in Havana, one of the handful of novels he referred to as his entertainments.
What is it that William Golding said about Greene, that he was the chronicler of 20th century humankind's consciousness? And I think that's very true, in the sense that he basically lived through every decade of the 20th century. We were born in 1904, died in 1991. But, you know, he just lived through all, you know, he was growing up during the First World War, was there during the Blitz at the start of the Second World War, served in Africa for MI6 in the sort of early middle part of the war, worked under Kim Philby in the late part of the war, resigned from the service before the war ended, and then set the third man in the bombed out ruins of Vienna in 1949, then wrote The Quiet American, presaging the Vietnam War in the 1960s, Our Men in Havana on the cusp of the Cuban Revolution, The Comedians in Papadoc's Haiti, you know, the voodoo dictator. He just lived it. And he was there, you know, he was constantly traveling. He was in Africa, he was in Malaya, he was in Vietnam, he was in Cuba, he was in Mexico during religious persecution in the late 1930s. You know, he just lived the 20th century, and it's all there in his novels and films.
For readers of a particular bent, the names roll off the tongue. John Buchan, William Somerset Maugham, Ian Fleming, Eric Ambler, John le Carré, Frederick Forsyth, Len Dighton, Alan First. These are the greatest spy novelists of the 20th century, the founding fathers of the genre. Readers who love the genre each have their own particular Mount Rushmore among these geniuses. Personally, I'm partial especially to Ambler and le Carré, but there's no denying that these are the authors who invented and transformed one of the most important genres in 20th century literature. And among them belongs Graham Greene. And not just because he also wrote, you know, serious literature, books like The Power and the Glory and Brighton Rock and The End of the Affair, but because he wrote some of the most ripping and exciting stories of international espionage ever published, including The Confidential Agent and Our Man in Havana, which is the book today's show focuses on. Whereas The Confidential Agent, written in the late 30s, is more of a traditional gripping spy thriller, Our Man in Havana, which Greene produced in the late 50s, was a satirical send-up of both international spycraft and of the genre itself. And Greene knew both well. He was a spy himself, not just a spy storyteller. In fact, in one way or another, he and several of his siblings were all involved in that world. And as Dr. Hull explains on today's show, Greene was a spy until the day he died. But he had a complicated relationship with the work, and those complications show up especially clearly in his book, Our Man in Havana. Dr. Hull explores those complications in his own new book, Our Man Down in Havana, the story behind Graham Greene's Cold War spy novel, which tells the story of Greene's novel, where the idea came from, how it evolved, and how it was influenced by Greene's various adventures, affairs, and political machinations. Dr. Hull is a senior lecturer in Spanish and Latin American studies at the University of Chester. His research focuses on British interactions with Latin America. He first visited Cuba in 1997 and has traveled extensively around the island during 17 further visits, often in the footsteps of Graham Greene. Recently, I chatted with Dr. Hull about his book, why he loves Graham Greene, and why Greene's story is so interesting. And it really is an interesting story, and Hull's book brings Greene and Greene's time in communist Cuba to life in fascinating fashion. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Christopher Hull. So, we know that Graham Greene was enthusiastic about espionage, about spycraft, about all those sorts of things. He wrote multiple books about it. He was engaged in it himself for much of his adult life. Where do you think that interest came from originally?
Ooh, well, I mean, the interest came originally by him being directly involved in espionage. There are rumors, there is speculation that he actually undertook espionage a little bit before the Second World War, but it's proven that he was actually recruited by his sister early in the Second World War, and after training in the UK was posted out to Sierra Leone in West Africa in a quite sort of inconsequential part of the world where not much was happening. His espionage was not very productive, not really much went on. He was mainly posted in Sierra Leone to monitor the smuggling of industrial diamonds. And he said in the whole time that he was there, which is about a year and a half, he didn't manage to identify or spot a single diamond.
So was he not good at it, or did it just not enough was happening?
This sort of ties in with one of his other novels, which is The Heart of the Matter, which is sort of based even more directly on his experience in West Africa, but not so much his spy work. Yeah, I don't think he was we have to be careful here because he wasn't exactly a spy per se. Sure, he was more a spy handler.
Right.
His actual role was to recruit locally, and so for other people to be doing the dirty work, and him just to be relaying their intelligence back to London.
So you mentioned his sister was involved in it, and his brother was. Yeah, his brother Elizabeth fancied himself a spy, right?
Well, there were two brothers, you see. The younger brother, Hugh Greene, who later became Director General of the BBC, he was pretty definitely undertaking some intelligence work in Germany pre-war. But it was the older brother, Herbert, the black sheep of the family, who was just a failure at everything he did in life. He worked for the Japanese in the 1930s. And then offered up his services to quite comically to MI5. So I do document that in the book because he was an inspiration for Greene, but Greene never publicly or even in writing acknowledged that his brother Herbert, which in itself at least on this side of the Atlantic is quite a common quite a humorous name, to call somebody a Herbert. I think this started in the 1960s, actually. But to call somebody a Herbert is to call somebody a fool. It's a bit of an insult. Huh. But yeah, his espionage was just a complete joke. But like I say, Greene never alluded to this. But I think it's pretty clear that he was one of the inspirations that went into the character James Wormald in Our Man in Havana a couple of decades later.
So three of the Greene siblings were legitimately involved in espionage. They were not frauds. And then one of them fancied himself a spy and wasn't good at it. He was a fraud.
Yeah, well, the brothers and then there's a sister. So there's three brothers and the sister. There's four of them actually, if you include including Graham Greene.
Oh, right. But so it's a family thing. How does it happen that all of these Greene siblings became wrapped up in this? Is there something about the Greene bloodline that made them all adventure seekers or something like that?
Well, they're definitely a talented family. Family with the and an intelligent family, with the exception of Herbert, who was the odd one out.
Poor Herbert.
That's a good question. Why did they? That there was an uncle, wasn't there? I mentioned him in the book. Another Graham Greene, who had worked in the sort of early. The intelligence services weren't that long-standing when Green joined. So there was an uncle who'd been involved. So maybe it did literally run in the blood. I think they were quite good at it. But, of course, Graham Greene's main talent was to write about it and to satirize it. He wasn't a very practical person, very un-James Bond-like person, highly impractical. I mentioned an incident when he was posted in Sierra Leone, when he managed to lock he locked himself out of the safe that had been sent to him because he'd confused the combination. And so he had to tow it up to headquarters and get it open with a blowtorch and then make out that it had been damaged in transit so they could send him another one.
So do you think that in some ways Green sort of saw a fine line between himself and his brother who actually kind of was bad at it, and Green, who recognized in himself maybe some of the potentiality to lean that way a little bit? Is it possible that...
Yeah, I'm not sure if he saw that in himself. I'm not sure if he would have made that comparison. I think his brother Herbert had made a real hash of spying and made a fool of himself, embarrassed himself, slightly embarrassed the family. For sure, Green mentions in his second autobiography, Ways of Escape, that he came across people both in Sierra Leone and back in London, who he realized were fabricating reports with the objective of earning more money. And this was particularly pronounced when the people that they were working for, be it the Germans, well, especially the Germans, when they realized that Germany was going to lose, you know, they tried to extract as much money out of them before the war ended, you know, before the source of funds dried up.
Right. So, one of the things that I was thinking a lot about as I was reading your book is, as you mentioned, Our Man in Havana is a satire. And he wrote The Confidential Agent and other books that are related to the topic of espionage. And he called them, entertainments, is that right?
Entertainments, that right. Yeah, he had a group of books that he defined as entertainments, although the sort of definition became a bit hazy as he progressed and he stopped. He stopped defining them in those terms. But yeah, Our Man of Venice is very much one of his entertainment.
So he calls them that, and in some ways, at least earlier in his career, as you just alluded to, it seems like maybe he doesn't see himself as pursuing... Well, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking too soon here, but the idea that there's a difference between those, quote, entertainments and the sort of higher brow literature that he was writing, such as In the Power and the Glory. Do you think he was out to write to sort of transcend that, you know, sort of the Ian Fleming type of work and write great literature in the spy genre, and thus his coining them as entertainments was meant to be sort of a tongue-in-cheek phrase? Or was he genuinely thinking about himself writing entertaining genre fiction that was of a different ilk than the highbrow literature he was writing?
It's difficult. It's interesting that you mentioned Fleming, and I mentioned Fleming a couple of times, both at the beginning and the end of the book. I don't think it's a coincidence that he called his spy James. Of course, we're talking about 1957 when he started to write Our Man in Havana. I'm trying to remember the year that Casino Royale was published, 1953, I think I'm correct in saying. And people have been quite critical of Fleming. John le Carré, certainly later, you know, we're talking about 1960s when John le Carré's career as an author really got going and started become successful, you know, really denigrated what Fleming had done with in portraying espionage. And I think to a certain degree, Green is both satirizing the world of espionage, but also Fleming's sort of very glamorous and actually very unrealistic take on espionage. I think that's one of the most interesting things about Our Man in Havana. And I hope I bring that out in my book and people come to see that by the time they finish it, is that it is just how ridiculous the world of espionage is, and Green portrays it in that way, but actually how the ridiculous side of espionage is actually a lot closer to the mark, a lot truer than Fleming's quite glamorous take on espionage. Mm.
So did Green think that Fleming's work was actually problematic? Like, did he think that Fleming was doing an injustice?
Yeah, I've never seen him. I haven't seen anything that he's written or said to say that. But that, to me, that comes out in Our Man in Havana. Mm-hmm. You know, because James Wormald is the antithesis of James Bond. You know, James Bond drives. Yeah. I think it's an Aston Martin. And there'll be James Bond experts listening to this. That's wrong. He's always driving, you know, very smart, fast, expensive cars. And James Wormald drives a sort of old, clapped out Hillman.
even their cocktail of choice is different, right?
Yeah, and you know, and James Bond sleeps with, you know, lots of extremely beautiful women from various nationalities, including other spies. And Green sort of inverts that, and the main lady in Our Man in Havana is actually his daughter, being seduced by a police captain on the payroll of the Cuban dictator. So he sort of inverts everything. So I'm sure that there is some allusion there to James Bond and Ian Fleming. Mm.
Did they know each other, Fleming?
Yeah, they did know each other. They did know each other. Of course, they'd both worked for British intelligence during the Second World War. But Ian Fleming for naval intelligence, and Green in Africa, and then under Kim Philby back in London. So quite different sort of experience during the war. Fleming was, you know, unlike Green, quite a practical person, and had, you know, seen or been involved in some of the skullduggery that he later transformed into fiction in the James Bond series, whereas Green's actual experience of intelligence was generally mundane. Mm.
Have you read Eric Ambler?
Not so much. No, no, I'm not very familiar with his work now.
Okay. Cause I was going to ask if you, I mean, he's always got a blurb on the Ambler books saying that how great Ambler was. And sure. I was wondering, Ambler was writing earlier. I think his career ended in the '50s or something like that.
Sure.
But he wrote a lot in the '30s and forties and he, in a lot of Ambler's work, there's a lot of things like arms dealers and regular businessmen who get caught up in it. And it reminded me a lot of what you're describing when discussing the actual history of the Cuban Revolution and the sort of regular business people that got involved in this international political intrigue. And is that something that you think Green was particularly interested in capturing, was the way sort of regular people got caught up in the world of espionage, people who maybe were not designed for it or built for it, but they sort of get trapped into it? Because he, as you said, he wasn't necessarily a professional spy. He was kind of a handler.
No, and if you look at the people who were working alongside him in MI6, they were like him from different worlds. I mean, he was, as well as Graham Greene in Sierra Leone, Malcolm Muggeridge was out in Mozambique at the same time, and then they were working alongside each other in London. Most of the people working in MI6 alongside Graham Greene were not professional intelligence officers. It was just something that they could turn their talents to during the war. I mean, Greene would have been pretty useless at, you know, holding a gun. So they recruited him for the intelligence world. Yeah.
Where did your interest in all this stem from? As you're talking, I'm thinking, man, you spent so much time researching and reading letters. I mean, you must feel like you know Graham Greene pretty well. So did it start with an interest in Graham Greene or an interest in espionage? Or where did your drive to learn about this
come from? I'd say the initial interest started with Latin America generally. through reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. That was an inspiration to go to Latin America for the first time in the early 90s. Then I seemed to see Green died the year that I first went to Latin America, which is 1991. And I do remember reading about this person, Graham Greene, this author who died, and think, oh, what a fascinating life. Hadn't actually read any of his novels at that point. Then traveled around Latin America. I think the Power and the Glory was the first novel that I read of his. Didn't really knock me over. I think the religious aspect, the Catholicism in it at the time left me a little bit cold. And then I sort of, Cuba was off to go, spending a couple of years in Latin America, traveling around and teaching English. I then went to Cuba for the first time and sort of fell in love with it. And read Our Man in Havana again. I'd read it before and just became always fascinated by the idea of an Englishman in Cuba. I just thought it was the ideal setting for that novel.
So then you dove in, you just started researching. When did you decide, I've got to write a book about this?
Well, to be honest, what the main reason I started this project was that I saw that there was a research, I suppose you called it a scholarship, available to spend a month in Austin, Texas, at the Harry Ransom Center, where they've got most of a lot of Green material. I was given that scholarship, went there for a month. Probably, actually, the main idea then was to write about all of Green's Latin America-based novels and travelogues. But in the back of my mind, Our Man in Havana was always my favorite novel, and Cuba was the country that I'd spent more time in. And after spending a month there and then going to Georgetown, where there's more Green material, and then Boston College up in Boston, I realized, yes, there's enough material here just to base a novel on Our Man in Havana. And there's a real story to tell here behind the story. That's what really came out at me, and it took a while to finally complete it. A lot of ups and downs on the way, even now I'm still finding finding out the odd little thing. I went to after basically the manuscript was finished, I went to Cuba for a short holiday with the idea of trying to source some good pictures for the book. And so I did find some good pictures for the book, but I also found a couple of tidbits that were too late for the book itself. So I hope to do something with those as well.
Yeah, I imagine having to conclude a project like that is...
there's always a cutoff point.
Yeah, yeah. Some people probably would like to just keep writing forever, and some people probably want to say, all right, I've got to be done with this.
it's like doing a PhD, There comes a point when you have to start writing. You get into the research mode, and it's quite comfortable, but money, more than anything, is the incentive to actually get a project finished and move on with your life and move on to something else. But I think there's a couple of little spin-offs that could still potentially be there with this project.
So you mentioned that you had read The Power and the Glory, and that you're very interested in Latin America, and you're studying Latin America.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Catholicism. You mentioned that it left you a little bit cold. So I want to ask you about that, because much of his work is consumed with his Catholicism, even if he wasn't always practicing it very, very closely. He seemed to have been consumed by it, at least psychologically. And then he's also consumed, it seems, he's got many novels about Latin America. Do you think then that the reason those two things, those two interests, those two parts of his life came together because of the degree to which Latin America is Catholic?
I think, yeah, for sure. I mean, as part of studying, looking for things related to Our Man in Havana, I looked at the diary that he kept in Mexico in 1938. Diary that mostly contributed to The Lawless Roads, his travelogue, rather than The Power and the Glory. But you can really see in that reading that how impressed he was, how moved he was by the faith of the Mexicans that he saw. I mean, in one sense, he hated his experience, and it was an extremely purgatorial experience that he had in Mexico. Obviously, he went there partly to report on the persecution of Catholics, although he missed most the worst phase of that. But yeah, he was impressed by that, by the devoutness, by the faith of the ordinary poor Mexicans. But he did find it a very hard experience.
Did that? So he's moved by that. I mean, in some ways, I guess he was kind of, I mean, he probably felt like he was being persecuted himself, because one of the reasons he had to stay in Mexico was because of the lawsuit from Hollywood, right?
Yeah, the Shirley Temple thing. Yeah.
And you discuss that in the book.
Yeah, but as I also, what we have to mention as well as his Catholicism is his manic depression. And, him going on all these journeys to very harsh parts of the world, especially the Third World, or to places in the world, especially after the Second World War, where there were sort of anti-colonial uprisings or insurrections. This was all the sort of, he was seeking out places that would, and experiences that would distract him, that would take him away from himself. Because, his manic depression really was a disease, really was a disease. He really suffered very badly from it, particularly actually in the 1950s. But basically, he'd suffered with it since from his adolescence onwards. And, of course, his experiments with Russian roulette are well known.
Do you think that the manic depressiveness and his infidelity were tied together? Because you mentioned,
I think definitely. And this long-term mistress that he had, Catherine Walston, American-born but married to a wealthy British landowner stroke politician, again, she sort of centered him. She was the one that he could bounce ideas off and have conversations with. Obviously, there's the physical side of their relationship as well. But, she sort of played hard to get for most of the 1950s, and her husband, while fairly amicable at the start of the relationship, funnily enough, started to restrict their assignations. So Green became pretty desperate. And so he had that going on with his life, this mistress who wanted to spend as much time with as possible. And as the 1950s progressed, he was spending ever less time with her. And all these journeys that he was undertaking via Indochina in the early 1950s that led to his novel, The Quiet American, Malaysia at the start of the 1950s, Kenya, the Mau Mau were involved in an uprising against the British in what was a British colony at the time. And then Cuba, mad, vicious Cuba, where everything or anything was possible, a sort of alternative to Las Vegas in the Caribbean, ruled by a US-backed right-wing dictator who, was killing a lot of and torturing and killing a lot of ordinary Cubans. And then Fidel Castro comes on the scene. Green becomes interested in that as well.
He is constantly, as you describe in the book, wherever there's something dangerous going on or some kind of revolution or something, he seems to be nearby, or he'll hear about it and then show up there as a Mexico.
And of course, what you're probably about to mention is the fact that it's pretty certain that his work for the intelligence services continued way beyond the end of the Second World War. In fact, the mistress who he was with for the last couple of decades almost the last three decades of his life, said in the memoir of their relationship that he was definitely working for the intelligence services up to his dying day, in a sort of informal capacity.
Do you think that the fact that he was always ready to turn up where something was going on, I mean, is that again like his sort of dangerous liaison, so to speak, with these various women over the years, or at least the infidelity? I mean, is that all tied to his manic depressiveness, this need to sort of escape, or was he
for sure? Like I said, to get away from himself and to get away from his home environment, which was very up and down. He didn't have a stable domestic life, although really I don't think he was ever suited for it. But his trips abroad were sort of ticking several boxes at the same time. That he was possibly working for the intelligence services. Two, he was seeking out material for books and films. Three, he was dealing with his manic depression. Four, in a lot of his foreign trips, he did have liaisons with one or other of his mistresses, because he didn't just have one mistress. He had a quite complicated personal life. So all this traveling, was satisfying all these needs.
So you'd mentioned in the book, and I think maybe already in the episode, that he would go, Graham Greene would go visit his daughter in Canada, Alberta, right? And she had a ranch up there that he had purchased for her, and he would go visit her and so forth. What kind of a parent was he? We know that his family life was obviously complicated, but what kind of a father was he to these children, especially given his work and the way he was constantly moving around and all that sort of lifestyle that he lives?
Yeah, I think, well, he was typical of his age, born in 1904. So I don't think he was emotionally very attached to his children. He's not very attentive in the sense of not being the sort of father who would play games with his son and his daughter. But certainly provided financially throughout his life, and obviously left them a lot of money after he passed away. So he's very good in that sense. Mm.
You mentioned it might have been part of the generation. Was he like that in other aspects of his life, though? I mean, was he sort of, I don't know if you would use the word cold, but maybe not particularly outwardly affectionate. Did that come across in other ways as well? Maybe not so much with his mistresses, but was that characteristic of him in general? Or do you think it really is just that's the generation that he was from? This is, you know, that was...
In terms of being a father, in terms of being a dad, you know, I don't think men from his generation were known for sort of their child-raising qualities. But, could be seen as quite cold. But as a person, again, partly due to his, or mainly due to his manic depression, he was a bit of a difficult person.
Yeah.
In the sense of extremely irritable, fastidious, obviously very up and down, the ups and downs of manic depression. Could be an extremely loyal friend, but at the same time, was quite quick to judge people and could fall out with people, could fall out with his publishers, became very irritable about agreeing film deals, could be, you know, would demand the most money possible and sell all the rights for a film, and then be annoyed when the film company director did whatever they liked with his film or his or an adaptation or even a script that he had written. Mm.
You mentioned he was loyal, though. So was there a reason why his loyalties would turn? Was it the manic depressiveness, or that kind of drove him to kind of disconnect with somebody?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, loyalty is a funny thing. I mean, the thing that crops up in the novel Our Man in Havana is this issue of loyalty. You know, should you be loyal to people, or should you be loyal to your country? And according to the novel and to Greene's own beliefs, you know, loyalty to people trumps over loyalty to one's country. And in fact, loyalty, or exaggerated loyalty to one's country, can cause wars and that sort of thing. So there's that sort of moral question enters there.
Do you think he, in his work, is he grappling with that question in a way that he is offering what seems to be a sort of definitive moral conclusion? Or is he suggesting that it's maybe more gray? I mean, maybe more gray than it is black and white. He spent his whole life, as we talked about earlier, as a spy. You know, when he died, he was apparently still involved in that sort of work, or at least late in his life. So he seems to have been loyal to his country in that sense.
Yeah, loyal to his country, loyal to, I think, the British intelligence services. Mm. apparently on the face of it loyal to Kim Philby, but perhaps not actually in the end.
Yeah, that's complicated.
That's complicated. Kim Philby was obviously his boss during the Second World War.
Yeah.
Well, after Philby defected in 63 from Beirut to Moscow, Green later, he got in a lot of trouble actually and caused a good degree of controversy because he wrote a sort of quite friendly introduction to Philby's autobiography, My Silent War. But I argue in my book that actually Green was aware that Philby was a traitor before he actually defected, and his disloyalty over the years was obviously proved at that moment.
Is that a common argument about Green?
Yeah, well, that's something new in the sense that that's something I draw out from one of the characters in the novel, William Carter, who's a spy working for a rival organization. Carter is a name that crops up in several Green novels. Carter, in reality, was one of the two classmates in his school that bullied him. And so he always had a thing about, suffered a lot. This is not physical bullying, but sort of mental bullying. Schoolmates who played on the fact that Green's father was the school's headmaster. So Green had divided loyalties at school between his classmates and his family. His father ran the school. So this created a conflict of interest for him at a young age, which was exploited by these two schoolmates, one of them being Carter. So I argue in my book that Carter in Our Man in Havana is actually, there are aspects of Carter which come from Philby. The fact, for example, that Carter in the novel has a stammer. Kim Philby had a really bad stammer. Carter smokes a pipe. When he meets Carter flying back from Jamaica to Cuba in the novel, Carter is smoking a pipe. Philby smoked a pipe. So the fact that Carter's working for the other side in the novel.
Very interesting.
So in 1957, 58, when Green wrote the book, it was published in October 58, this is 5 years before Philby defected in 1963, but it was suspected that he was the third man. Talk of Philby being the third man after Burgess and MacLean had defected in the early 50s. Third man, of course, playing on the fact that Green's 1949 film set in Vienna was called The Third Man.
One of the great movies ever made.
I think pretty much everyone's in agreement about that. That yeah, it's in the top. Some would say the top five. I would say the top three films ever made. You know, it's up there with Citizen Kane, isn't it?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, depending on when you ask me, The Third Man is my favorite movie. So let me ask you this then: given that this book is a somewhat satirical in a sense, is he being sympathetic towards Philby in the book in this portrayal of this character that you would argue is meant to be Philby? So is he sympathetic to the choices that Philby made, to the actions that Philby took, and the motivations behind those choices and those actions, in a way that perhaps the rest of British intelligence, the British government, was not? I mean, I guess, how can a government be sympathetic to a traitor, I suppose? But did that alter the way he thought about the work that they were doing?
Well, first I would say that Carter in the novel, he enters the novel sort of halfway, two-thirds of the way through the narrative. He's not a major character in the novel, although he's an important character later on. I don't think that... No, he certainly doesn't portray Carter as a sympathetic figure. No, very much a sort of sinister. And he makes fun of Carter in a way, because at the end of the book, just before he shoots him dead, and there's some parallels here between, we've just talked about The Third Man.
Yeah.
There are some parallels, which I mentioned in my book, between Our Man and Havana, you know, another Graham Greene, Carol Reed collaboration. In this action at the end, where, of course, if you remember the main narrative, The Third Man, Holly Martins arrives in Vienna looking for his friend, Harry Lime, who has died, hasn't he? He thinks that he's been buried in Vienna Cemetery. Mm-hmm. It turns out he's very alive and well. And at the end of the film, there's a chase scene in the sewer mm-hmm. where Holly Martins actually shoots dead his friend Harry Lime. In Our Man in Havana, there's a similar scene, not in the sewer, but in a sort of cobbled street. The film as well, like Third Man, is shot in black and white. Outside, actually, a brothel, and Wormald, the main character, shoots Carter. Dead. So there's that parallel. But no, he's not portrayed in a sympathetic way, no.
Do you think Graham Greene viewed the work he was doing as noble and the work that the British intelligence were doing as noble? It seems to me that in a lot of his, you know, what he calls entertainments, and then, in a movie like The Third Man, there are questions of...
morality. I mean, you mentioned the morality of Third, and this is a constant theme in Greene's work as a whole, you know, from beginning to end. Morality is there really throughout his novels, his films, throughout his life, really. So it's a key theme.
But you would argue then that there's a gray area for him as far as the work that they were doing?
Yeah, sorry, you mentioned that a few minutes ago. Yeah, black and white or gray. And certainly Greene saw life as, shades of gray rather than black and white. And it was those shades of gray that he liked to exploit in his novels. And he certainly lived them in his life.
As I was reading your book, actually, I was wondering if perhaps that gray area was what drew him to the work of Spycraft. That the sort of complicated nature of that actually was sort of motivating for him.
Yeah, perfect for him. You know, I mean, it obviously interested him. And getting back again to his manic depression, I think it was an outlet for him. It was an outlet, obviously, and it was a theme in his work, in his novels, but in his real life as well. Hmm. Yeah. And also, the world of intelligence gave him extra income, and he was. This surprised me studying Greene was just how much he was quite mercenary, I think, with regards to money. You know, squeezing the last penny out of everything he did.
Yeah, every screenplay.
I'm sure he did the same with MI6 as well, in terms of them paying for it, them financing a lot of these trips, or partly financing them. But whether they were financing his trips or not, and there's no paperwork that I've unearthed, because the MI6 files are very much closed.
Yeah, yeah.
It says that, but it's pretty evident that they were. And when they weren't paying, he was still keeping his eyes and ears open. Whenever he was traveling around the globe, and he visited many trouble spots around the world, the east and west, and north and south, he had his eyes and ears open. Mm.
It does seem to me that people, that a novelist or an artist in some way would make for a useful spy. There's an Eric Ambler novel where actually one of the main characters is a photographer who they hire as a spy. How many novelists became, or how many, well, novelists became spies or vice versa over in the 20th
century. Sure, there's a whole list of them.
Yeah.
Oh, Somerset Maugham on your side of the Atlantic. Hemingway did some intelligence work, didn't he? FBI in Cuba during the Second World War, not very successfully, but again, it was a bit of a lark, a bit of a game.
Yeah.
But it paid quite well, and it was an interesting diversion. And Greene certainly sought those diversions from his manic depressive self.
You know, it's interesting because I'm a big Le Carré fan, and I was, but in a sense, you know, you read The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, for example, and a lot of his stuff was written after he left. I mean, as far as I know.
I don't think he worked for MI6 for that long, really.
And it seems like he became disillusioned with that gray area and then left and produced fiction that kind of processed that and challenged the sort of ethos of spycraft, whereas Green, it's like the opposite. That gray area was what drew him to it, in a sense.
No, I think it was a real blessing for him, you know. And you know, his actual official service, of course it's not publicized at the time, was quite short. But like, you know, he kept up these contacts informally for according to the last long-term mystery of his life until the day he died.
Well, okay, so a couple more questions here before I let you go. Where do you think that Our Man in Havana, which you've studied so closely, ranks in the Grand Green canon? There are obviously screenplays. There's the essays and the journalism that he wrote. And then there are so many novels, many of which are can be considered, you know, very highbrow literary works, The Power and the Glory, The End of the Affair, and so forth. In some ways, in my opinion, Our Man in Havana seems to bridge the gap between his highbrow literary, you know, quote unquote literary stuff and what he called his entertainments. But for me, The Third Man might be the greatest thing he ever did. Of course, that was a collaboration with Carol Reed, but what's your take on where it belongs in the canon?
I don't think he or any of his fans consider it his best novel, nor that I consider it one of his weakest. I think it's certainly the funniest. You know, it's the one where the most satirical of everything he did. I argue, you know, the Quiet American perhaps is considered his most prophetic novel because of its, you know, published in 1955, but it sort of foresaw, predicted, prophesied North American intervention in the 1960s in Vietnam. But I sort of argue in my book that Our Man in Havana is up there as well, not only because of its tale about invented weapon sites, prophesied the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, but because of this story about invented intelligence and bungling at the top of the British government and governments in general, sort of presaged what happened with the WMD debacle decades later, weapons of mass destruction. And just as a very slight coincidence, WMD, of course, are the first, middle, and last letters of Wormhold's name, just to add to the... to add a little bit, another ingredient to it. So yeah, so I'd say one of the funniest and one of the most prophetic, one of the most prophetic. But yeah, in terms of rank, I would say, you know, somewhere in the middle.
What's your personal favorite Graham Greene novel or work?
Well, my personal favorite is Our Man in Havana because it's set in Cuba, and I have this sort of long-standing connection to Cuba. Also, its exoticness sort of appeals to me, with the exoticness of Cuba in general. Let's see. In terms of his work, you know, you mentioned The Third Man. The Third Man's definitely the best film. No doubt about that at all. And actually, when you think about it, that not many of the films were that successful. For me, Brighton Rock is the second most successful film.
What do you think is his greatest novel? If you just separate kind of your own taste.
Green never considered himself great or any of his novels great, you know, he didn't consider himself a Tolstoy or a Dickens. And I think he was right not to, you know, I mean, he's not right up there. What is it that William Golding said about Green, that he was, you know, the chronicler of 20th century humankind's consciousness? And I think that's very true, in the sense that he basically lived through every decade of the 20th century. We were born in 1904, died in 1991. But, you know, he just lived through all, you know, he was growing up during the First World War, was there during the Blitz at the start of the Second World War, served in Africa for MI6 in the sort of early middle part of the war, worked under Kim Philby in the late part of the war, resigned from the service before the war ended, and then set The Third Man in the bombed out ruins of Vienna in 1949, then wrote The Quiet American, presaging the Vietnam War in the 1960s and tragic American involvement. Armen and Havana on the cusp of the Cuban Revolution, the comedians in Papadox, Haiti, you know, the voodoo dictator. You know, he just lived it. And he was there, you know, he was constantly traveling. He was in Africa, he was in Malaya, he was in Vietnam, he was in Cuba, he was in Mexico during religious persecution in the late 1930s. He just lived the 20th century, and it's all there in his novels and films. So that's the thing that most impresses me. He considered for many years The Power and the Glory his best novel. But after writing The Honorary Consul,
that's a later one, right?
Published in 1973, okay. Which sort of really is at the start of the Dirty War in Latin America. Mm. He considered that his best novel. Mm. But even like late in the 70s, when he was pretty old, you know, born in 1978, he published The Human Factor, which is another take on British intelligence, which is a great novel, a really good novel. Mm. But I think, personally, I think that's crying out for a remake. Hmm. Because the first version of the film was it just had all sorts of problems, including running out of money, and it was a bit of a desperate effort in the end. Hmm. But you mentioned John le Carré and what they did with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, a TV series, and later a film, quite recently actually.
Yeah.
They could do a similar job with The Human Factor.
That would be
a really good novel, and it could be a really good film.
That would be excellent. So let me ask you this. When you look at the whole of his work, that canon, you know, do you think it's more driven, like if you take it as a whole, not as individual novels, but if you add it all together, do you think it's more driven or speaks to a sense of hopefulness about mankind and about the times that he lived in? Or is it more driven and sort of founded upon pessimism about that? Like if you read the whole thing and you have to add it all together, or is that an impossible question to answer?
Well, I'd like to say the former, but I think actually ultimately Green was a realist.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that stands out for me for Green and why I like him is that he's completely an unsentimental person, both as a man and in his work. And I admire that. Personally, I'm not a great fan of sentimentality. Mm. I'd like things to be really great and rosy in reality.
Yeah, right.
Fortunately, especially everything that's going on in the world at the moment doesn't make me particularly optimistic. But I'd like, you know, we have to hold on to hope, don't we? And I don't think Green was a complete pessimist, and he really relished fun moments in life and really lived life to the full in terms of his personal life, perhaps quite selfishly, but in terms of travel and drink and having sort of experiences all around the world. I think, you know, there's a bit of both. Ultimately, I'm saying he was very much a realist, but...
You're saying he was complicated.
Yeah, he definitely complicated. No doubt about that. A complicated person.
We touched on this a little bit earlier, but do you think that his complicated relationship with his sort of on again, off again Catholicism drove his pessimism, or was that where any sense of hopefulness came in for him? Do you think, or what do you think he would have argued about that? Because in some ways, when I read Green, it seems that there's a begrudging sense, a begrudgingness that goes along with his Catholicism. Like he wants it to be there, but also doesn't want it to be there. He wants to be a part of it, but then also doesn't want to be a part of it. Kind of like the whiskey priest, I suppose, in The Power and the Glory. And so does that create for him hopefulness, do you think? Or do you think in a sense, his Catholic belief and the degree to which he practices Catholicism was actually a sort of pessimism at work?
Ooh, I find that difficult, and I think you've summarized it better than I could. I'm reluctant to make a judgment on that, actually.
That's fair.
I think my sort of conclusion about his Catholicism is that like other aspects of him, it was... I don't think you can take it at face value, and I think to a certain extent he liked it to sort of... you know, it's part of his public persona, you know, the Catholicism. I think he believed it, and I'm saying it was completely false, but yeah. it distracted from some of his sort of
Catholic proclivities.
Yeah, no, and it very much, and I'll say this at least once in the novel, very much a maverick Catholic, very unorthodox Catholic, especially in the way that he lived his life. Mm.
So all this, the complicated nature of Graham Greene, and maybe that's what made him a valuable spy for the British government, just the fact that you didn't know what he was.
I think he was an asset. He was an asset. He really could, like that Dutch beer of Heineken, reach the parts that other people couldn't reach. And, for example, reach the people and the situations that, for example, diplomats couldn't reach for all sorts of reasons. Mm. For all sorts of reasons. You know, the front was a sort of left-leaning Catholic novelist stroke writer and sometimes correspondent, foreign correspondent, who could really literally get to the front line of conflict, meet the people at the very top, Castro or Matorrijos in Panama later in his life, Ho Chi Minh in the 1950s in Vietnam, and speak to them on a sort of informal basis, whereas, somebody in the diplomatic world is always meeting somebody on a very formal basis and maybe is not able to tease out the same information and see the same things that Green could. Hmm.
It's kind of like, it reminds me of what Holly Martins is able to do in The Third Man, where he's able to get where the diplomats and the officials couldn't get to.
So much of what's in his novels is based on reality, including the characters. It's too simplistic and too black and white, getting back to that, to say so-and-so is so-and-so, like Carter is Philby,
or
Holly Martins is so-and-so, or Harry Lyme is so-and-so. But, you know, these are all amalgams of different people that he met and knew in his life.
And then his imagination worked on for a while.
And I think the smoking of opium in the opium dens of Vietnam in the 1950s, and he sought opium in the late 1950s in Havana, maybe helped him in unlocking his very rich subconscious.
How very Sherlock Holmes of him.
Well,
thanks to Dr. Hull for joining me on this episode of Lee Romania. Remember, you can find his book, Our Man Down in Havana, The Story Behind Graham Greene's Cold War Spy Novel, wherever books are sold. And thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Close Reads Pods. If you like this episode and this show, please hit that review button in whatever app you're using to listen. It really does go a long way in helping us spread the word, which of course means we can keep making more episodes. For all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks for listening and happy reading. Talk to you next week.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.